Better believe it. I mean, I started out as an analog design engineer at Bell Labs. So, next. Well, this is the point about audio I really want to make in this talk. When I started out, I discovered I like to do stuff with sound. Everybody that I ever talked to academically was dead set against it. Don't do that. It's full of bullshit. Don't do that. People hate it. It's a waste of time. Every time I started out, teachers in high school, professors in college, management said, no, don't work on audio. Work on speech at Bell Labs. Of course, I was working at Bell Labs, which to some extent invented the whole field of audio, so it's an ironic thing, and I hear that. Next, please. What did I learn at CMU about audio? Now, one thing it doesn't see on there is I worked at the campus radio station, and the first thing I learned is at least wideband lines are terrible, and I learned that again. Yeah?
What is CMU?
Carnegie Mellon University.
Thank you. Can you turn it up a little bit, please?
There's no mic. This is only for recording. This is only for recording. I'm not being reinforced. I'm not being reinforced.
Can you turn yourself up a little bit, please?
Maybe.
Thank you.
Okay. And I hung out at the radio station, and it's not the phone company that you can blame for it. It's physics. I mean, trying to get that signal down those little teeny tiny wires all next to all those other wires is a hard problem. And as strange as it sounds, that's one of the reasons that MP3 got invented. We'll get through to that in a minute. Go ahead, Flip. I'll give you a little bit of Bell Labs. Harvey Fletcher started pre-World War II. He started working in 1929. He left in the early 1940s. Did a lot of work at Bell Labs that underpins the work in hearing. Stevens and Zwicker and a lot of other people built on his work. And he actually built someone in Helmholtz's work, believe it or not. Helmholtz is the first person to actually figure out that the ear had a frequency sensitivity, or at least the first person that bothered to write it down. He established the understanding the ear is a frequency-sensitive organ, along with understanding more or less how the frequency divisions work. And this was one of his highest quality devices. Does anybody know what this is? Is it a microphone or a speaker?
Microphone.
Yes. It is an electrostatic, biased electrostatic microphone, which also turned out to be the most accurate loudspeaker they could make in 1930. So the answer to that question is yes. Next. Fletcher did a bunch of masking experiments. Masking is where one sound makes it impossible to hear another sound. And these experiments proved that the ear was a frequency selective device because signals at one frequency mask signals at another frequency very differently than they mask signals near each other in frequency. And he also came up with some measurements of how that scale actually worked. And this whole point that ear is frequency selective leads to a few points that people understood in 1935 but aren't too clear on today, I'm sorry to say, which is that signal-to-noise ratio doesn't mean a whole lot unless you know what the signal spectrum and the noise spectrum are. And then everything has to take this frequency selectivity and the time selectivity that goes along with it into account. I see Yvonne smirking over there. He knows this way too well. Okay, next. Well, suppose I made a signal that consists of a signal and noise, where the signal itself is narrowband noise between 950 and 1050 hertz. The noise is a tone at 1 kilohertz, which is 6 dB lower in energy than the signal. Will you be able to hear the tone?
Yeah. You can pick it out.
Not a chance.
Not a chance?
Not a chance. So that says I can come up with a signal for which a 6 dB signal-to-noise ratio is transparent. Okay, now let us take another signal. I have a 20 kilohertz sine wave, and I have a 1.5 kilohertz sine wave 60 dB down from that. That has a 60 dB signal-to-noise ratio. Can you hear that sine wave? No problem.
I can't hear 20K.
Well, that's the point. You can't even hear the original stimulus, but you'll hear the 1.5 kilohertz because it's around your ear canal resonance. And matter of fact, in a quiet room, you can back that down to 80 or 90 dB, and you can still hear the tone. So what we've just established from two very simple things is between 6 dB and 90 dB, signal-to-noise ratio means jack. If you get up over 100, 110, you're probably in good shape. And it doesn't read so badly as you think on things like CDs, because the CDs with the 96 dB maximum signal to noise ratio spread that noise out, so the noise is not concentrated in any one part of the basilar membrane in the ear. So it actually isn't that much of a problem. So that doesn't mean that there's a problem with CDs, interestingly enough. Yes?
Is that broadband noise what gets shaped when you do noise shaping up into... Like,
when you do noise shaping, you shape the broadband noise and put it where it's even harder to hear, exactly. But the point is, the broadband noise, that means the energy per root hertz, the energy per frequency, is low. And what matters to your ear is not the total energy, but is the energy at any one frequency above the threshold of hearing. And if it's not, you don't care about it. On the other hand, these were very carefully designed, one of them to be way above and way below. It's not an accident. Next. Well, I asked this question already. I gave it away, but you can take people that know Steve know how to upload Octave. He can tell you again if you need to know how to upload it. It's a linear algebra program. You can load the signal processing and audio pieces of it. You can take an FFT. You can generate the noise. You can generate the signals. You can go listen to them. And it's very, you know, once you do it and listen to it yourself, it sort of kicks you in the teeth. Okay, next. Message. Well, these older tests, and this is all, by the way, this is all stuff that Fletcher and then Fletcher and Stevens got into. This is even pre-Zwicker. Show the signal-to-noise ratio is mostly harmless. And anybody, how many people have seen Hickenberg's Guide to the Galaxy? So we know what mostly harmless means. It's useful in extremes. 3 dB is probably going to suck, and 110 dB is probably going to be cool. 120, you're good. There is an interesting thing about people who talk about full 24 bits, though. If you consider the charge in the electron and consider that to get that signal-to-noise ratio, you're going to need 2 to the 48th electrons per second coming out of that microphone peak. Figure out what that is in terms of current. You're going to realize why you don't see too many microphones with the dynamic range. Physics has this funny way of butting in. And it butts in other ways, too. The absolute threshold of hearing at your most sensitive point is just barely above the noise due to the air bouncing off your eardrum. So, you know, physics butts into all parts of this. And whether we like it or not, Mark can tell you this, physics continues to work, doesn't it? People have tried many times in audio to violate physics and say, oh, but we can do this with software. Good luck. Next. Okay. So this leads to basically one of the big fights that we have in audio. We have what I will call, I apologize for characterizing, but on one side we have the SNR weenies, and on the other side we have the fantasy people. And one of them says, the signal-to-noise ratio is great, what's your problem? And the other person says, no, it sounds like... And they may both be right. It may have a really good signal-to-noise ratio and sound bad because they're not testing the same problem. One of them is talking about aesthetics and do they like how it sounds. The other one is talking about, is it accurate? Accurate is not always good. Now, maybe some of you guys in the audio thing hear about how this system is more accurate. Probably isn't. Preference rules. Remember that. Preference always rules. If you like it, you like it. And that's all there is to it. And if you don't like it, you don't like it. And if it's giving you 6 dB peaks with 90 dB signal-to-noise ratio out of a magic loudspeaker, you might not like it, even if it's perfect. It depends on what you like. That's the whole problem. It all boils down to preference. Next. So we have a start of this conflict. This is a long time ago that it started, but I don't know if you remember, probably I don't, but back when there were Victrolas, people were even arguing about whether you should use steel needles or thorn needles for the Victrola, because thorns are more natural. Now, at this point, the system wasn't even radically approaching a linear system, but this split started very early on. And there are people who think of it as a natural thing. When you get to digital audio, you can't think natural. It's mathematics. You cannot think natural. You have to understand the math. It's counterintuitive. And if you don't sit down and digest the math and try it for yourself, that's another thing Octave is good for. Try it for yourself. And you'll find out it really does work. Sometimes it's hard to believe, but it really does work. And this is what we have. We have these counterintuitive things. We have the difference between preference and accuracy. We have the question of measurement, what to measure. These are all part of the problem. If we can work together, we can solve some of this. 20 years ago, I don't think we could have because, frankly, couldn't analyze the systems well enough. But now we can. Next. So, some definitions. Loudness, I've done this five times here now already. Loudness is the internal sensation level. It's perceptual. SPL is sound pressure level. It's a measure of the power in the atmosphere at your ear, but it's only a measurement of the pressure part, but we won't go deep into acoustics today. Smirking, I saw you smirk. But the point is, these two are very different things. If you have two signals that are very different in spectrum, the same energy, they may not have anything near the same loudness. If you just increase the gain of a signal by 10 dB, it will roughly double in loudness. If I take a signal in the first 10 bands of the year's analysis bank, and I double the energy by putting a signal in the second 10 bands of the year's analysis bank, now it will go up. Now the loudness will double, but you only added 3 dB to the energy. So loudness and sound pressure are only kind of sort of... As a rule of thumb, if you turn up one, the other one's going to go up if you don't change the spectrum. But when you go to changing the spectrum, processing things, flattening spectra, doing things like the kind of processing you do to enhance articulation, you can ask, you know, Bob should talk about that someday. Then, energy, you can make a signal that comes out of a 1-watt amplifier that's louder than a signal that comes out of a 15-watt amplifier into the same speaker easily. With speech, using speech for both of them, no problem. It all depends on what you do to it. Next. Well, first, this is... I have been yelled at from the floor when I point out preference is what matters. The reason you hire a really good mixing engineer and a really good mastering engineer is because they have a good understanding of what other people prefer. They do the part that deals with the preference. Then you send it off to the reproduction system, which should be accurate so that the preference is maintained. That's how it's supposed to work. Is that how it really works nowadays?
I hope so.
You mean after they put it through the compressor at the radio station?
Oh, well, that's after.
But preference is inviolate. You cannot argue preference. I mean, people with certain kinds of hearing difficulties may actually like a narrower band signal because you're not exciting certain nonlinearities in the basilar membrane. People that have a broadband hearing impairment are actually more sensitive to noise in the environment because we're all used to hearing noise going on constantly, but they don't hear it. They have no sensation until it goes over their threshold and it startles them. There are all sorts of things that happen. You can't argue with preference. And when somebody says, that bothers me, I'll bet it does. So it goes. Now, this is a modern view of perception. This is, somebody said the philosophy. Who was it mentioned a philosophy? This speaks directly to it, because this is the understanding of how your perceptual system works. You have tons of megabytes coming in from the eye and the ear. It's hard to set a number to it because it's pulse position modulation. The position and the pulse rate both matter. But in the eye, it goes into lateral inhibition, which sharpens edges. In the ear, it goes into the frequency filtering. And that gives you some number of megabits that go into what I'm calling feature analysis. And what happens here is this reduces things to kilobits. It throws out almost everything you get here, but puts an interpretation on what you got. Now, you notice this feedback thing here from cognitive level. You can steer it. Everybody hear that hiss? Did anybody notice that until I said it? Yeah. The point is, I just proved. You just refocused, you heard the hiss. You weren't paying any attention to it, you were ignoring it until I said, can you hear the hiss? And then I didn't. This is what happened. You just refocused all the way back out here to the edge of the perceptual system. And so that those things come down to kilobits, and they can be retained maybe for a second or two. I should mention here, this is retained for up to about 200 milliseconds. And you cannot retain it farther than this. This is retained short-term memory for a second or two. After a couple seconds, it starts to fall off really fast. And then you reduce that to objects, which you give names to. That's what we actually talk about, is objects. And now you're down to maybe 10 to 20 bits per second at most. And we're doing this reduction. Me sitting here talking about what sounds like a complicated subject, the actual bit rate is under 10 bits per second probably. But what it's doing, but it's being represented in the way your brain works, which is a very heavily encoded system, to put it mildly. But again, you can steer it. So the whole point here is this massive feedback. This leads to problems in testing. This leads to problems in mixing. This leads to problems, I mean, who's had a ghost fader happen to them? And that's what's going on. Your expectation gives you, you know, you have an expectation something's happening, so you think it happened. And then you realize it didn't. And this is what creates a big problem in the audio industry, because people do not do blind listening. And when you don't do blind listening, if you think there's going to be a difference, you can bet there damn well will be a difference. It may not be the difference you expect even. That's the irony of it. It doesn't even if you think I'm going to change this and it's going to get better, just depending on what you happen to focus on when you refocus this whole system, you may think it's better, you may think it's worse. And what you wind up with is noise. People that have done a lot of really critical listening in blind testing actually perform worse in non-blind testing, because they're always busy questioning themselves. What? Did I really hear that? Was that there? I can't tell. And since you can do blind testing that gets you down to the threshold of noise in the ear, it does work. Now, it's not easy to do. And some of the things that have been passed off is, this blind test proves this. No. You run a crappy test, you get crappy sensitivity. Live with it. You know, that's true anywhere. Next. Yeah, well, you see why the blind... Does anybody here not see the reason for blind testing? Good, thank you. It doesn't mean you wear a blindfold. It means you don't know what... You try to set it up so the only difference presented to the listener is the sound in your ear. You don't change what the visual stimulus is. Well, you may change it from A to B so you can tell which one's which. But you don't change anything else. And no, you can't ignore that from hints for the other sense. You notice that at that object point, that all went into one pipe. That's not a joke. It all goes into one pipe. It's all going to get mixed together. I don't care what you want it to do. It's going to get mixed together. The way that human beings look, we have crappy claws, we have crappy teeth, but we survive out in the wild. How did we survive out in the wild? We can figure out what to do with our senses better than other things. And that integrating all of the senses is how we survive to get to this point. So you, and when you say, oh, I cannot do that, nobody has actually found a person that can show they can ignore suggestions and tests. And that, of course, leads also to blind tests where it's single blind instead of double blind, where when the experimenter all starts looking all anxious, the subject's going to react. That's just how it is. You can't change anything except the sound. And you can be sure that you were responding to something if it wasn't a blind test. You don't know what. It could have been the phase of the moon. I mean, it could have been you just refocused. One of the things I did back when I was in college is I had some members of an audiophile group in Pittsburgh, and I had some EE students. I had a Southwest Technical Products 30 watt per channel amplifier. Remember those old things? Slower than mud, but they worked. And they were also $30, and a kid who's living basically off his mom's Social Security and going to college, an expensive college, that's a good thing, right? And I found a burnt-out Mac 240 in the garbage. And when I say burnt-out, I mean the power transformer and one of the output transformers had wax running out of them. There was not, basically, one channel had no resistors remaining. Well, I tried a little stunt. I put a 5-volt filament transformer under it that lit up all the tubes. Now, didn't even light up the 6-volt tubes. Right, I grant you, but it lit the tubes up. Set up, I put a single piece of wire I found in the junk, nailed one end to the back of the stereo cabinet, brought the other end out, tied a knot in it, put it in the box, and put a big old motor reversal switch I also found in the garbage, and it said tube and transistor. Something, I've forgotten the exam, something over 90 out of 100 trials for the audiophile group voted for the tube amplifier. 79 out of 90 of the engineers voted for the transistor amplifier. One, and that's worse than it sounds because it was actually 79 out of 80 because one guy who now runs a stadium sound company from Pittsburgh, was the other guy. He flipped the switch twice, stuck his ear in a speaker, flipped the switch, and looked at me and said, "Smart ass." So we count his 10 in the total, even though he didn't bother to answer. But that tells you how much it influences you. And no, people were sincere. They were sitting there. They were concentrating. Now, this test was not in any way accurate because I was playing the same LP over and over and over and over again. So, and you know what that does to an LP. But that tells you how perception works. And it's not hallucinations. It's not confusion. It's not anything but expectation and knowledge of what's being presented. Next. And that's bad. Well, like I said, you can't argue about preference. What do you want to do with your listening experience? It comes down to that. If you're doing this for scientific purposes, you've got to do one thing. If you care about that WAF, Mark, you've had some trouble with the wife acceptance factor in clients. I mean, if you have trouble with that, you know, it's what do you actually need to solve here? You need to look at what you need to solve. Sometimes it has to be looks. I mean, if you think the chartreuse wires sound better, I'm not going to argue. You like them better. If you tell me they make a difference in what comes out of the other end of the wire, we got an argument. Next. Your preference is not my preference. It is your preference. Now, this goes back to like a cartoon I saw, you know, my elevator, not your elevator, my elevator, from an old cartoon. The point being, when you have an aesthetic experience that's not double blind, you're describing your preference. I don't share your preference, probably. I might, who knows. They may not match somebody else's. Preference does not extend beyond you. I mean, now, that's not quite true. There are people who are good at anticipating what the public will prefer. That's their job. That's a good thing. But the point is, your own personal preference does not extend beyond you. And the preference may have nothing to do with the sound emitted during the experience, like I just explained. So you have to be careful how you listen to things and how you test them. Click. When is preference bad? Well, if I'm trying to figure out how auditory masking works to try to build a better audio coder, I don't really want it preference. It's not supposed to sound different. It's supposed to sound the same. So I need to do a double-blind test with critical material, and I need to figure out what's audible and what isn't, what's causing the problems, what isn't. Now, the point is you cannot proceed in science if you don't have a falsifiable result. Falsifiable means, can I come up with an experiment that will either prove or disprove this hypothesis? If you can't come up with an experiment, you're not doing science. And that is a basic key to remember. And if you're doing this based on sighted preference, you can't prove that you actually heard what you think you heard. Now, if you're saying, I prefer X, that's great. But if you're trying to do science, you have to do science. Anecdotes are not, however, worthless. There are a lot of anecdotes, and people have been dismissed for various anecdotes in the audio industry that turned out to be very important. The problem is that you can start with the anecdote, but you have to be able to sit down and measure it. And this is where guys like me need some help from people like mastering engineers and mixing engineers and so on. These things that everybody agrees make a difference. It would be nice to be able to sit down and figure out, A, confirm that they do, and B, figure out what's going on. Then we learn something new. And, you know, when 1,000 people think it, It could be mass hysteria, but it probably isn't. This, you know, with all that refocusing going on in your auditory system, there might be something to it. I mean, one of the arguments I've been hearing is about analog versus digital mix buses and how one sounds better than the other and so on. Well, analog mix boxes invariably soft clip and invariably have different frequency shaping the more you add to them. It's physics. It's going to happen. You can't avoid it. That might sound better too, you know. Might not measure accurately, but it might sound better. But until you can sit down and measure the thing and find out what it does with controlled signals in a controlled setting, we're not going to know what it does, and we're not going to know why whatever is happening is happening. So this is the kind of thing you can do to get to the bottom of these things, and it's not easy, and it takes time. And that time is a problem because time is money. And so that's a big problem. But if we want to get to the bottom of this kind of thing, we can get there, but it's not going to be simple, and it's going to take work. And there we have it. Well, another one is basically, how many people have wanted to throw something at somebody when they said, well, the sound-to-noise ratio is good? Anybody here has just had an urge to throw something at somebody when they said that? And how many people have said, oh, but I can hear this perfectly well. I tell you, the tube amplifier sounds better. Except the switch doesn't do anything, of course. You know, so this there's built up a lot of hostility and is not improving life in the audio business. Get it right. You know, don't ignore the artist. Don't ignore the mixing engineers. And don't ignore the scientist types. We all got something to add, but we all have to do things differently because of the nature of the process. Next. And do I have to tell you all this hostility is a bad thing? I mean, I don't even dare walk into a couple of the audio stores around here. They find out my name and they throw me out, even though I've never said a word to them because they read stuff on the net. This does not improve the situation and certainly doesn't improve their bottom line. So now, go back to the how this all went, how MP3 came about, because I hated rented analog lines from the phone company. After college, I went to Bell Labs, and I was officially discouraged from working on audio because we weren't really supposed to do audio as a field because of the 1939 consent decree, where basically Western Electric had to spawn off Westrex and all those guys. We're going to see there's a few things. I worked for Dave Gidman, who worked for Jim Flanagan, who worked for Max Matthews. What does that have to do with it? Well, next. Well, you see, we weren't supposed to do this, but, I mean, everybody knows Max Matthews is a big computer music guy, so I worked two levels down from a guy who did a lot of computer music. So you can see a little bit of tension in the management chain here. And it didn't keep people from being interested. Bell Labs was a place where if you were interested in something, that was good. Go figure it out. Next. See, the first summer, I went to Bell Labs and built a speech coder. It ran barely at 8 kilohertz. A to D this big, D to A this big. Barely made it to 8 kilohertz. It was a whole 8 bits. That was a big thing. I mean, we're talking about, you know, 10-watt A to D that could do all of 8 bits at like 12 kilohertz because you had to have a little time to complete the feedback loop. And I sat in Max's lab next to Elizabeth Cohen. The irony of that, she's one of the ex-presidents of the AES, which was fun. I put this in here because she was sitting in the front row at the AES. So I just had, and she was working on something else, working for computer music. But this last sentence turned out to be a very important sentence as far as my future job prospect. She said, you know, if we could run this faster, we could try this on music.
When was this?
75. And Jim Flanagan looked at me and said, I think we could sell that to Max. Next. And, of course, Jim Flanagan, I don't know, you guys know Jim Flanagan, he is 98 or something like that. He's still with us. This works well. His back is sort of dead, but, you know, he's the guy that, you know, the artificial larynx people used to use in the 1950s. He's one of the guys that invented it. He worked on the ADPCM coding. Your cell phone owes a debt to this guy because it wouldn't work without it. He was a really good manager and a very even manager, and he was curious about everything. And his comment is, well, you know, we can't do audio, but that's a transmission problem. We can work on transmission problems. Next. And how would he get support? Well, he worked for Max. And we'll see. I don't know if you know what that thing there with the batons is. One of those batons controls pitch. The other one controls intensity. It's a digital theremin, basically.
Radio drum?
What?
Radio drum?
Well, you could also use a radio drum. It also had a contact sensor. You could do all sorts of things with it. Mm-hmm. Max made that. He made several versions that he used it to conduct the virtual orchestra with a MIDI, with an old MIDI synthesizer that had 8 voices. Ooh. I mean, last I heard, saw him, he had, I think, he was up to something like 4,000 voices or something like that. Like bank, an entire bank of modern MIDI synthesizers. He could do cool stuff with it, too. He's unfortunately not with us anymore. But and Mac made some other things. This is his electric violin, which sounded like a violin, but was designed with 3 loudspeakers and filtering so that it mimicked the resonance and the dispersion pattern of the loudspeaker in 3 different directions. Of course, the player didn't hear what the audience heard there. He also worked with some other guys who made a ceramic violin that you couldn't tell audibly the difference from between it and the Stradivarius. The problem is that everybody, all the violinists hated it because it felt cold and hard. And it turns out the really old wood works because it's really stiff in one direction and really, really, really anisotropic, really floppy in the other direction. And I forget the guy that did that, but I know he's still around. There's some really wonderful work on the physics of violins that was done in like 1978 at Bell Labs. Next. And Max is why this all happened. So he is my boss. This is why it happened. Next. So they came back and said, okay, instead of spending $800 on an ADD, we'll spend $20,000 on an ADD, and it will actually work fast enough that you can sample at 32 kilohertz. Literally, it was a single thing from Analog Devices about that big. That was a 12-bit ADD. And it didn't come with the sample and hold. You had to put the sample and hold in front of it. It didn't. The D to A was like a third of the price because it had to be a lot faster. So we made this thing. Made this thing literally on point-to-point soldering on perf board. We had a dynamic range of 110 dB relative to 10 volts with all the digital analog stuff hanging around. And we got that on this board. And we did it with old, anybody remember DBX 202s?
We made them.
You made them, okay, well, okay. that's how we made it work.
Yeah.
Because it had that exponential input. And the exponential input, so you could put an inverter, so you could put 2 of them, they matched well enough that you could invert the second one so that you got the same gain through it.
Yep.
And that was an essential characteristic that made this whole thing work. So to make a long story short, I wound up staying at Bell Labs. It came that the spring of 76, I could have gone and worked on image processing for the Navy, or I could go back to Bell Labs and learn about signal processing. And at that point, I couldn't learn about signal processing at Carnegie Mellon because they didn't have anybody that did anything beyond control systems. They had really good control systems guys, but there was no DSP group there yet. So I was also flat broke. That had something to do with it. So I went back to Bell Labs, and so I learned signal processing. I've never had a class in signal processing. I learned it from Dave Goodman and Larry Rabiner and Nikhil Giant and Rich Cox, Jim Flanagan. Turns out you can learn a lot from those people. So basically, in 1979, we did a two-band commentary-grade codec. It was 56 kilobits. It was 2 bands. It used a quadrature mirror filter. And it was much like G722, those of you know what G722 is. The thing that's interesting, G722 came out of a different part of Bell Labs, and they didn't even mention this until I sent them the paper. I gotta love it. But the point of this is not that it was good because it was a first guess, but this carried the hint for what was wrong and why we needed to actually pay attention to perception. And notice this rate happens to be digital data service rate, because the point was to use these to replace that transmitter link, that obscenity blankety blank transmitter link. I mean, we tried something. We had a loop going from Carnegie Mellon downtown to Pittsburgh and back. It's like 16-mile loop. And we measured, it had over 3/4 of a second of dispersion. It was a heck of an all-pass filter. You put click into it and whoop, came out of it. Go ahead. So what did we learn? We made this codec. We put a bunch of classical music through it, sounded great. Put rock through it, sounded great. We put pipe organ through it, sounded great. Put a male vocal through it, sounded great. Then we put Emmylou Lou Harris through it. What was that? This is, well, to explain, the way your ear works, masking low frequencies mask high frequencies. High frequencies do not mask low frequencies. Take a soprano singing a cappella into this codec, and you can hear all the quantization noise, like, well, that was a hint. And that, you know, led to go talk to the psychoacoustics guys. Oh, yeah, and there's this upward spread of masking. Okay, we had some talk, and we figured out what we might be able to do, and then we didn't do anything. But that'll be obvious why in a minute. Because that's when Jim Flanagan decided to build his Ray microphone. So I don't have any pictures of the first mic and hardware. It had 49 elements. We used CCDs and rate multipliers set up to be symmetric, which is tricky for rate multipliers, but set up to be symmetric. And this 49-element array was a rack about this high, had an 8080 in the bottom that did the steering, had two sets of steering hardware because it scanned the room with one and to figure out where the sound was coming from, and then pointed the other one that you played into it. It worked. It was rather large. And then we went after a few other. We went on to a few other things from there. But that, its descendant still lives in the Murray Hill Auditorium. Next thing. But that's what it turns into. Now that is a 4-octave array. And that's Gary Elko. You know, GW Acoustics. That's Gary Elko there. And that's the modern hardware. Every one of those now has an A to D on its back. Okay? That thing has a bus running around it, has an A to D on its back. It runs at like 50 kilohertz, and it works a lot better than the first array. And it all comes down here and gets processed, and it can now actually sit down and use some autocorrelation to figure out where people are talking and tell speech from noise. And that's the array that's up there now. But that happened after audio coding got started again. So once I started doing the audio coding, I sort of got pushed out of the hardware stuff. Go ahead. But, well, we made a digital earphone. It had 4 bits. It sounded like 4 bits. Drove the elements with these plus and minus 200-volt supply op-amps. That's how we drove them, and we had to set them up to be an exponential approach so you didn't get nonlinearities out of the D to A.
Did you build those out of discretes?
Well, actually, there used to be a company called Industrial System Services in Erie, Pennsylvania. And I built the first one out of some FETs, and I sent it to them and said we wanted 20. So the answer is yes, kind of, but I only built one of them, not all 16. And the other thing is the reason there were 16 of them is because you had to make all the elements the same size. Otherwise, the dynamics didn't match and it didn't work. I haven't seen much like that since. So this was what was going on. And then this is why we didn't do it. We had a pretty good memory space in the data general machines. We had 32 kilobytes. The chance of that fitting a perceptual model is about the same chance as me winning Mr. Universe. I mean, it would not, just not going to happen. And then we got the Alliance FX8. And next. I was the only Unix user in acoustics research. I used the Research Unix system a lot because Steve Bourne and Joe Conan wrote the system called UCDS, which would build wire wrap boards, which when you're doing digital processing, you build a lot of those days. And it had 64 megabytes of memory. And I was the only Unix user in the department. I repeat that because the question was, how does this work? Here, JJ, you test it.
What year was that?
Early 80s.
Okay.
And it was also, by the way, 88 megaflops instead of 4 megaflops. Mm-hmm. It was fast. So there's another story there, but I wrote a test program which implemented this masking model that I wanted to implement for about 5 years and made a coder out of it. And like, that can't be right. 4 bits? No way. Yeah, it works. Wait a minute. But that brings us to the point, I'm going to go back to my point of considering perception, and I'm going to play some tracks here. Here, I'll play these from over here. I'm going to play 3 tracks here. I'm going to play them in a random order. One of the tracks is the original. The other two have noise injected at 13.6 dB. So they have literally, in their original form, had 13.6 dB signal-to-noise ratio. Your job is to figure out which two of the three have the noise. Okay? I will start with one of them. Okay, that's one. Now we're going to do two. And the third one. Okay, now we don't have to ask you which, if the third one was included here, but which of the other two had this 13.6 dB signal to noise ratio?
Yeah, second.
How many people say the first one? How many people say the second one? It's the first one. But I will point out that when you run this, if you run that in a well-designed ABX test in a quiet room with good headphones, you can detect it reliably. But it's the same signal-to-noise ratio as that stuff that comes out in the third one. And I mean, there's no tricks. There's no phase shift. It's not a phase shift thing. It's not time delay. It is literally frequency-shaped noise added, which sort of drives home the point of considering perception, I think. Next.
The mouse.
It's over here on that side. And just hit you should be able to just go.
No, because it doesn't have the focus.
Oh, you want a focus. Oh, okay. Yeah. You just move
the focus off the PowerPoint.
Okay. Hello. There's, it's over there somewhere.
I just saw it.
Yeah, there here, is. Mouse. I can't see without my glasses.
Here, Mickey.
There it kill is. That.
Yeah. Good.
Now you go over here. Now you can go.
Next.
Have I made the point? Signal noise ratio, mostly harmless. Now, you don't want to know. And Yvonne, you'll be you'll laugh. I just got my last paper as an AE for the Signal Processing Journal was somebody who was optimizing AAC by increasing the signal to noise ratio. Conveniently, I could send it to 3 reviewers who I knew. The smoke did come back. Now, if he was doing it by dropping all of the thresholds, that would be great, but that's not what he's doing. So I'd love to have a nickel for every time. I'd buy you all pizza or something if I did. Go ahead. From there, we went to perceptual transform coding and MP3. Perceptual audio coding, which turned at that point in perceptual audio coding, AT&T and Lucent split. I went with AT&T, and we worked on what was called NBC, which was stood for non-backward compatible, which turned into AAC. If you read the AAC standard and you read the 1992 paper on PAC, you'll notice if you take the 1992 paper on PAC and add temporal noise shaping, you have you have AAC. Now, then we went to the perceptual sound field reconstruction stuff, which is an attempt to sample the perceptual cues in the sound field, which you've seen a little bit of, and which we have some of that we can actually play some back. That's what we're going to play back in the second half of some of that and some other stuff. But you can go look. You guys have all seen this because all of this talks you've seen. Go ahead, next. Which is why we have it. Perception doesn't correspond to broadband signal-to-noise ratio. You're going to integrate all the senses, and when you reproduce one point in a room, that doesn't get you anything. This I haven't done entered into it in this talk, but I've given the talk about diffuse versus direct sound fields. I've given the talk about differences in the sound field at different positions. Trying to equalize at one point is just not going to do much. As a matter of fact, it might do bad. Fixing the time delay is good. I'll go along with that. But it all comes down to one basic idea. What are all of those things doing? You have to consider, how is it going to be perceived? Is it going to be perceived with other cues, without other cues? All of that matters. Next. What's left? Well, there's lots of things to do. Thing is 20 years ago, we couldn't have handled this stuff. I mean, you know, when I built the PXFM coder, people were claiming you'd never be able to use it because it was too complicated. It ran just barely in real time on the Alliant. That was 88 megaflops. That was a super fast computer. By the time we got it reduced to 8-channel AAC encoder, it ran in 20% of a 1 gigahertz Pentium. So, you know, now we have audio is in an interesting place. Instead of being in the place where you're always scraping for processor power, we got 10 times the, maybe 100 times the processor power we know what to do with. We have problems, but mostly it's not getting worked on because of the commercial issues and because of basically, you know, I have more than once bumped my nose in somebody who just says, oh, just get out of my face, you stupid engineer. I mean, it gets a little tiresome. And so a lot of stuff just doesn't happen. There's stuff that can happen. I'm retired. Thank you. I understand. You know, I'm still interested. I'd like to work on some of this stuff. It will have to make way to Yellowstone for the summer, but that's okay. Okay. And so what we need understanding from everybody. It's not one-sided. Everybody's guilty. It's not one-sided. Everybody's a little guilty. If, you know, by the next time I see somebody waving around THD, I'm going to actually what I'm going to do is shake my head and turn around and walk off. It's better sometimes if words do fail me. THD doesn't mean jack. So I'm just tired of it. It's partly why I'm retired. I mean, I get a lot of flack. And now it happens in the AAS, I get flack from the engineers for being way too mystical, and I get flack from all of the producers for being way too scientific. Well, yeah. So, next. This is, by the way, some things we can go. That's Gary Elko's sound field capture microphone. And that is a really good loudspeaker. You notice that's got octave elements, only they're Bell Labs. They can build their own elements. And this guy is actually a guy I miss having out here. You need somebody to work in the machine shop, you want Bob. You want Bob Goodley. There's no doubt. So there's things that people are doing. I don't have any pictures of the stuff I did. I never took pictures of it. I mean, why am I going to take pictures of it, right? I should have, I guess. Go ahead. And that's the end of the first half. And we will set up the listening space here while you guys munch on cookies and stuff. Why don't we put the cookies up there?